The reading this morning is taken from Genesis chapter 28, verse 10 to 22, and that can be found on page 22 of the Bibles or in the inside of your service sheet. Jacob left Beersheba and went towards Haran, and he came to a certain place and stayed there that night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, Surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it. And he was afraid and said, How awesome is this place! This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. So early in the morning, Jacob took the stone that he put under his head and set it up for a pillar and poured oil on the top of it. He called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of the city was Luz at the first. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, If God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God, and this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house. And all of that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you.
Thanks so much, Jess. Be a help to me if you keep the passage open. We're going to be looking through some of the headings that are on the inside of the sheet as well. I think Samuel mentioned already, at the end of this, after our prayers, we're going to have some Q&A time. If you are technologically minded, you might want to type in questions online, or there'll be a chance to stick up a hand if that's more suitable for you. I wanted to begin by looking at this experience that lots of people have of feeling that heaven feels closed to us. All kinds of people describe this sort of experience. You don't have to be religious or irreligious. Both categories describe this. Famously, this is how C.S. Lewis described his experience after he'd become a Christian and he was experiencing unanswered prayer. This is in his book, A Grief Observed. And he said, a door slammed in your face and a sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. After that silence, you may as well turn away. That was his experience of prayer, even after becoming a Christian. For some of us here, perhaps we feel we're just not the religious or Christian type of person. I had a friend I was growing up with. We grew up in the same Christian youth group. And he described how that for everyone else, faith just seemed very easy. And for him, it was like a subject at school that he was no good at. And so along with, you know, theoretical physics, he gave it up as soon as he could. Heaven, he said, just seemed closed to him. For others of us, perhaps we know this experience, but we feel that the problem is not so much with God, but we feel it's with us. And we know our own lives. We know that we've made a hash of things. And it just feels a little bit too late now. And at best, we're just confined to being God's little disappointments from here on in. And it feels like we're shut out from the inner track. Today, we had a wonderful reading from Jess. And it's a moment in Jacob's life when he had this experience. It felt like heaven was closed to him. And yet, wonderfully, in this passage, we're going to see how it is that God stages an intervention. And even though Jacob has not been seeking God at all, God intervenes and he breaks into Jacob's situation. I've divided the passage into three chunks on your sheets or on the heading. So into the mess of our sin, number one, Number two, the Lord comes down to us. And then finally, so we can entrust ourselves to him. So let's look at this passage under these three chunks. And the first one is into the mess of our sin. So the first two verses we looked at, verses 10 and 11, I love these verses because in just a few sentences, the writer Moses, he masterfully sets a scene. And each phrase actually of these first two verses kind of gives us a sense of just how hopeless Jacob is. Look at verse 10. Jacob left Beersheba and went toward a place called Haran. And he came to a certain place and stayed there that night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place to sleep. If you've been with us this series, you'll know that this guy Jacob, he's on the run from his brother Esau. His brother Esau wants to kill him. And actually, it's not altogether surprising his brother wants to kill him. Jacob has brought all this problem on himself. He tricked his brother out of an inheritance, and he's now living with the consequences of his own sinful, selfish actions. And two generations ago, God called his grandfather, he was called Abraham, and he called him out of a dead-end life in a place called Haran, and he promised him to a promised land, and he led him to this promised land of Canaan. And now here in our verses, we have Jacob, and he's on a journey fleeing the promised land and reversing the purposes of God. And he's taking this whole story back to square one, effectively. And so even in that first line about the place names, it's a reminder of just how utterly hopeless his situation is. No future, no direction. He's basically heading back to the start. And you got to feel for Jacob. You know, at one time in his life, he probably thought that God had some good purposes for him. There was a prophecy at his birth that he, even though he was the youngest, he would know the Lord's blessing. And perhaps he felt that in his own way, he was doing his best to pursue that blessing. And now somehow it's all unraveled. And now here he is, and he's left with nothing. And where is God in all this? You know, maybe faith felt like one of those subjects at school he wasn't very good at. And now here he is. And it's also a picture here of Jacob being utterly alone. Jacob is on a journey, and he's made a stop off on the journey. And the place he's stopped off at is, well, Nowhereville. It's described as, in verse 11, a certain place. Actually, it does have more than one name later in the passage, but at this stage, it's left nameless. It's a place, it's a nowhere. It's a place with no hospitality, no human contact of any kind, it seems, at this stage. Jacob had grown up desperate for his father's love. And yet he'd grown up in one of those households where it was always obvious who was the real favorite, and it was always Esau. And Jacob felt this very acutely. He had even dressed up as his brother in order to hear his father's well done. I mean, a psychologist would have a field day, wouldn't they? I wonder what that does to a human being. The only way I can get my father's approval is by literally pretending to be someone I'm not. And you know what happened? The whole thing backfired. And in one day, he'd lost everything and everyone. He lost his father, who sent him away. He lost his brother, who wants to kill him. He lost even his mother. His mother was the only one who ever loved him. And he's never going to see her again. And it's a picture here of him on this journey. And he is now utterly alone there in Nowhereville. And finally, these first two verses paint a picture of being utterly powerless. That is, defenseless. Jacob ends up in verse 11 using a stone as a pillow. It's a strange detail, but it captures in one line, really, a way of saying, here is a guy who has got nothing. If you were on a journey and you were staying the night somewhere and there was no motel, at the very least, you would roll up your whatever garment you had to use as your pillow. Everyone does that. But Jacob is so destitute, no shelter, no protection, nothing, that he has to use a rock for a pillow. That is a picture of being utterly powerless, defenseless. And so here in these two verses, it's a picture of a guy for whom heaven seems utterly closed. He's hopeless, he's alone, very alone, and utterly powerless. And the worst of it for this guy is if he stops to think about it at all, he knows it's all his own doing. Deep down, he knows it's his own sin that has brought him to this low point. And he must feel there's nothing he can do. He's stuck. He's just got to live it out now. And there we are. And by rights, this should actually be the last we hear of Jacob. You know, he's blown it. This should be the end of his story. But it's not, because wonderfully, into this desperate situation, into the mess of our sin, we discover, and this is a glorious truth, that the Lord comes down to us. Sorry, Mike, this is going a bit crazy and jumping ahead. Here we go. The Lord comes down to us. Let me read to you verse 12. And Jacob dreamed, and behold, we're going to have three behold, so three things to look at. And behold, there was a ladder. You'll notice the footnote says, or a flight of steps set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, that's the second one, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. Actually, I think that flight of steps is probably a better rendering of this than ladder, because this stairway is wide enough for a stream of God's angelic messengers to be passing each other on it. So I guess wider than a normal ladder, at least. And although Jacob has been unaware of it, what he's discovering in this vision, that there is an unseen world. And what he's discovering is it's frantic with activity. He's seeing God's agents, these angels, affecting God's purposes across the world. They're sent out and then they come back again, returning from their assignments. And he's seeing it all. He'd missed it before, but God opens his eyes and he sees what's really happening. And then the final behold, verse 13, and behold, the Lord stood above it, or as the footnote says, above or beside him. Actually, grammatically, it could be either. It could be the Lord is above it, above the stairway, so he's at the top. Or it could be the Lord is above him, above Jacob. So he's standing over him as he sleeps at the bottom of the stairway. And I think that the latter is much more likely. Because after the dream, when Jacob wakes up in verse 16, the first thing he says in verse 16, surely the Lord is in this place. The Lord is here, right down here at the bottom of the ladder. And I think what Jacob has discovered is that though heaven seems closed, and for him it felt inaccessible and bolted shut, he can't approach God. Wonderfully, what he discovers in this vision is that the Lord has come down to him. God is in this place. Wow. And another thing which points to the fact that God has come down to him is the way that this passage connects to and contrasts with another passage we've already looked at in the book of Genesis. And we've already seen a picture of this on the screens. But this is, does anyone know what this is trying to render? Yeah, Babel. So this is Genesis chapter 11. The Tower of Babel. It's a famous story about some builders. And they say in chapter 11, verse 4, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. And it's a little picture, I think, of human religion. It's a picture of humanity's proud assumption. If we can just get our act together, if we pull together, try hard enough, we will be able to ascend and climb our way up to the heavens, up to God. And it's a similar outlook. Many religions teach this today, don't they? If you can just keep the five pillars, if you can just follow the eightfold path, whatever it is, if you can keep these standards and try and live a nice little Christian life, that will get you to God. That's what people assume. But the next verse, as you read through chapter 11, the writer actually makes a joke about the absurdity of this whole approach to life. And he says in verse 5, the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. And the idea is that, you know, they think they've made this colossal tower and it's so tall that they're about to storm heaven and reach their destination. We can get there. We can do it. And the joke is on them, because from God's perspective, he has to come down and see this pathetic, insignificant little thing. And he's not quite sure if he can see that feeble attempt down there, but he just makes it out. Oh, bless, isn't it? It's so cute that they think they could get to me through a tower. Isn't that cute? And that's the joke that's on them in verse 5. But as you read through chapter 11, there's another joke on them at the end of the passage. For the Babylonians, in their language, Babel means the gate of God. This became a great empire. We're going to get there. We're going to arrive at God's very dwelling place, the gate of God. And Moses, when he's writing up the story of Babel, he gives a more comic explanation for what Babel means. Because after God confuses their language, it says, verse 9, therefore its name was called Babel, Babel. It sounds like it does in our language, like the word for confused. Their empire is called Babel, 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 because of that time God made their speech confused, so they had to babble to each other. And it's another joke from the writer about just how ridiculous proud human empires really are. It's not a gateway to God. It's just Babel, Babel land. It's confusion city. So there's this old story back in chapter 11 about a silly attempt humans made to try and get to God. And now our episode in chapter 28 is evoking, you know, echoing that. The builders thought they could create a Babel, a gateway to God. And they thought they could ascend to God by their own works, by their own power, their own wisdom. And they discovered that the whole thing was a colossally expensive dead end. This was like the HS2 Birmingham to Manchester rail link. You know, all that investment goes into it, complete waste of time and energy. And it was a sign that human religion is not going to get you where you think it will. And actually, at the end of the episode, God ends up judging them for their religious pride. Whereas here we are in chapter 28, here we have the true gate of heaven. Jacob calls it that in verse 17. And this time, the initiative is all from God. And it's not bottom-up religion. It's the other direction. It's top-down, because he, God, comes down to us. And instead of it being in the city of man at the center of an empire, Babylon, built by those who are trying to make a name for themselves, it was significant that this gateway happens in Nowhereville, in a place that God chooses. And it's in a place where the proud and the important people wouldn't even think to look, in the middle of nowhere. What a contrast these two approaches are. And this is part of the reason why I think it is better to say in our passage, verse 13, the Lord stood beside him. That's the whole point. It's the opposite of Babel. He has come down to the bottom instead of us having to climb up to the top. There's a story told. Another C.S. Lewis quote, but he was attending a conference back in the 20th century. It was all about different religious perspectives, and they were debating if there is something that is unique about Christianity amongst the world religions. And various suggestions were put out, you know, what makes it slightly different. And Lewis piped up immediately, "What is unique about Christianity? That is very easy. It is grace," he said. And he said, Christianity is not about us climbing to God. It's about God coming to us. That is what Christians celebrate every Christmas time. Christmas is the opposite of human religion. That is when Jesus comes down to us, because we couldn't get up to him. And Jesus said, this is in John chapter 1, "Truly, truly, I say to you." So this was our theme verse, wasn't it? "You will see heaven open," Jesus said, "and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." And Jesus is echoing this passage, and he's saying, "I'm now here, and I am the stairway." You know, Jacob, he saw that stairway. Well, here I am. I am the one who links heaven and earth. I am the down-to-earth God. I am the one who has come down, and I've become the gateway, the stairway to God, and therefore now anyone can have access to God, but it will have to be through me. This, of course, is why Jesus' message, you know, famously, he went out to preach, and his message was repent and believe the gospel, the good news. That's what it means. And it's a significant reason why it was good news. There's a world of difference, isn't there, between good advice and good news. Good advice is what human ideologies are always trying to give us. And maybe, you know, you're on your doom scroll, and in every other post that comes up is offering you brilliant advice. Try this, do this. And we're bombarded with it. Here is how to improve your life. And it's exhausting, and it's very, very different from good news. That's what gospel means. It's not about here are some top tips of what we might want to do. It's this is great. God has done it all. And of course, the good news is that what we couldn't do, fix a relationship with God, we couldn't bridge the divide, God has done for us. And he has come, and especially through Jesus' death, brought us a way back to God. So that's where we are. And this is what Jacob discovers, not simply actually that God comes down to us, but when he comes down to us, he comes in our hopelessness and aloneness and powerlessness. And he comes to us in our hopelessness with his promise. That's the green bit. He comes to us in our aloneness and gives us his presence. And he comes to us in our powerlessness and defenselessness, and he gives us his protection. So let's go through those one by one. The Lord comes down to us with his promise. Pick up from verse 13. Behold, the Lord stood above it, or more likely beside him, and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and to your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west, to the east, to the north, to the south. And in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And for Jacob, this is a wonderful moment. This is a confirmation that the promise, which was first given to grandpa, to Abraham, and then to dad, to Isaac, is now at last coming to him and to his offspring. And as we've seen already in this series, this is the gospel promise. That's what it's called in the New Testament. This is the promise that God's salvation will come to the whole world through Abraham's seed, through Christ, ultimately. And this promise, this certain hope, is a total game changer for Jacob. For Jacob, from this moment on, everything is different, and yet everything is also the same. Let me try and explain that. Everything is the same because he's still got a stone for a pillow. He's still got the same difficulties. And yet, from here on in, everything is different because he knows where this story is going to end. And I want to suggest this is actually very like the Christian's experience. Everything is different and everything's the same. One writer describes this dynamic by getting us to imagine two workers, and they're on a factory production line. And the first one is told, at the end of the year, if you work hard, you're going to get £10,000. And the other is told at the end of the year, if he completes the year, he will get £10 billion. That is, he will get the factory owner's whole inheritance gifted to him. And you got to imagine these two workers. How does it impact them? Well, at one level, not much. You know, day to day, it's the same factory, the same production line. They've both got to do their work. It's tough work, and they have to do it. But another level, everything has changed. You see, the second worker, he goes to work every day whistling. He's got a kind of buoyancy. He's got a spring in his step. When everyone else is kind of arguing, being chippy and elbows out, trying to push the other one down and lift themselves up, he can be generous. He's not kind of trying to push everyone else down. He can befriend people. He can help them. Everything's changed for him. Well, what has changed? Well, he has a promise. He has a certain hope about what is just over the horizon. And I want to suggest that is a picture of what the difference that the gospel promise makes for the Christian when we start to take it on board, when we let it actually impact us. Everything is the same and everything is very, very different. So as Jacob discovers, the Lord comes down to us and he comes with his promise. And he comes next with his presence. Look at verse 15. The Lord says, behold, I am with you. I'm with you. These are beautiful words. A couple of weeks ago, Andrew Satch and I had a difficult meeting, and we'd taken a stand on something within our denomination, and we had to go to a meeting where we're going to get a hard time for the position that we'd taken. And it really was a difficult meeting. It was exactly as we predicted. And we both remarked afterwards how much easier it is when you're going into those sort of situations, having an ally, having a partner in crime, someone with you in the difficulty. And I guess you probably know that difference, don't you? Maybe we're the only Christian in our year at school or in our department at work. But what a difference it is when somebody comes into our class or into our department, and then we have someone alongside us, someone who can stand shoulder to shoulder with us. And that is a real comfort when you get someone with you. But of course, as Christians, we know whether we get the ally in the workplace or not, we are actually never alone. Paul, the apostle, he celebrated this in 2 Timothy 4. At my trial, no one came to stand by me. That is, he had no human help. But he says, the Lord stood by me and strengthened me. That is the great promise for the Christian. Actually, God's with you in whatever situation you're in. He's with you to stand with you and protect you. And we talked in chapter 26 how this is really the greatest of all the promises of God, his presence with us, his commitment to us. And we talked about how it's a little bit like when you go through the wood with the gruffalo and you have nothing to fear. There are real threats, you know, there's the owl and so on, there's the snake. But if the scary one, the gruffalo, is with you, there's no one and nothing left to fear. He's got his eyes on us for our good and for our blessing in all that happens. So this is what Jacob discovers, that the Lord comes down to us with his promise, with his presence, and finally, with his protection. Look at verse 15. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go. And I will bring you back to this land. For I'll not leave you until I've done all that I've promised you. I want us to just stop and consider the impact of this promise in Jacob's life over the next 20 years. Let me try and describe what I mean. It's difficult to tell the difference between an exile and an exodus when you're in the middle of it. Let me try and explain what this means. This is actually very important and very relevant to our lives in this world. Jacob is going to be cut off. He's going to be reversing his grandfather's journey. He's going to be away from the promised land for the next 20 years, actually right until chapter 35. And it's going to be a time of terrible suffering and oppression. He's going to be mistreated by his uncle Laban. And to Jacob, it would feel like a time of punishment. It would feel like exile. Do you remember right at the beginning of the book, Adam, he was exiled from the Garden of Eden. He was cast out because of his sin. And as we read on in the story, we're going to discover that it's really... that he was exiled because, sorry, as you look back at it, you see it's a kind of punishment on him. It's exiled because of what you've done, and you've got to bear the weight of that. But as we read on in Jacob's story, we're going to discover that this is not really a time of exile for him. It's a time of exodus. It's going to be a time of protection and liberation. And the whole story, and you're going to see this more as we go through the Jacob story, it's going to be framed as the story of Israel's exodus. The great story for the people of Israel was how they were oppressed by Pharaoh in Egypt. And then Moses came and declared, let my people go. And then finally, Pharaoh, he continued to refuse, but Israel escaped anyway. And they plundered their oppressors. And the oppressors then pursued them. And Israel then escapes through the Red Sea and heads for Mount Sinai. And we're going to read this Jacob story. And we're going to see it is exactly this pattern. Jacob is going to say to his oppressor, to Laban, send me away that I might go to my country. And Laban's going to refuse. And then eventually Jacob will plunder him. And then Laban is going to give chase and go after him. And Jacob is going to have to escape across a river and head off to a mountain. And the whole way that the story is going to be told, and you're going to see more of this in the weeks to come, you're going to see it's a very Exodus-y type story. And part of what we're learning in this whole story is that there is a massive difference between an exile and an exodus. Now, if we have God's promise, we have God's presence and protection while we're in the middle of the hard times, it changes our whole experience of them. And we know that we are not being punished. We're not in exile. We are in the midst of an exodus story. And at one level, you know, not much is different. Our circumstances are similar. You know, he's going to have 20 years of difficulty with his uncle. And yet, right at the outset here, he's being told that God is with him. God is for him. God is working for his good in the midst of the trials. He's going to protect him. And therefore, like that guy on the production line, Jacob knows that this is a game changer for him. It means that he can have a different perspective on what's happening. This is what Christians are called to. We're called to rejoice in our sufferings, as Paul puts it in Romans 5. We're to consider it pure joy when we get trials, James says. And do you see the point? Because we know God is with us, he's got this, and he will use our hard times for good, it changes the perspective. We're not people of exile, we're people of Exodus. So, where have we got to? Well, we've seen into the mess of our sin, the Lord comes down to us. And then in the final few verses, we see Jacob's response to God's revelation. And in particular, Jacob's realization that if the Lord comes down to us in grace, therefore, we can entrust ourselves to him. And I think the first take came for us is that we should start where we are. I think some people, when they read this passage, they're quite negative about Jacob and his response there in verse 20. So God has come down into his life and he's very generous. He doesn't condemn Jacob. He doesn't set any conditions. He just stands over him and he speaks love and grace and acceptance over him. And yet Jacob's response to God immediately begins with a condition, an if clause. Then verse 20, Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God. And we look at that and we think, well, it's not the best response he could have given. It's definitely not up there with grandfather Abraham, you know, who's all in right from the start. In fact, I think we could describe Jacob's response as at best cautious or tentative. And yet I think there's even an encouragement in that fact for us. And it tells us that we don't have to make a perfect response. We don't have to have total confidence in God in order to start the journey with him. This is what we learn from Jacob. He starts where he is. And his response is a bit mixed. And he says, yeah, God, I think I can trust you. From what I've seen, I'm going to give it my best shot and I'm going to make a start on that basis. And I wonder whether that is actually the message that some of us in this room need to hear. We've been putting the decision off. We've been holding God at arm's length. We're waiting perhaps until every question is answered, till we're 100% there, you know, completely satisfactory in all our questions. And the call of this passage is, no, you don't have to do that. Just start where you are. Start the journey with God today. Start with what you know. And I think finally, the message for all of us is this passage is also a call, not just to start where you are, but to worship this God. Let me explain what I mean. A few chapters later, in chapter 31, verse 13, God says to Jacob, I am the God of Bethel. That's a strange way to introduce yourself. Why does God say, I am the God of that place, the God where you had that staircase vision? And the point is that Jacob is now forever to relate to God on the basis of what God has just revealed to him here in this place on this day in Bethel. That's what the place gets called in verse 19. He's saying, remember, Jacob, I am this God. I'm the God who intervenes. Do you remember that day when you were hopeless and you were alone and you were powerless. And I didn't wait for you to seek me. I came down to you and I came to you with my promise and my presence and my protection. Actually, this is not just something that happened. This is who I am. I am the God of Bethel. And you need to always remember this and always relate to me on this basis. This is the kind of God I am. And I think this is so helpful for us in the way that we relate to God. All of us have, and we pick up, don't we, like passive smoking, kind of wrong views of God. And we pick up different ones, perhaps from our upbringing or from our schooling or from our personalities sometimes. And maybe we've learn to relate to God as if he's like a fierce headmaster, this terrible God with impossible standards, and he's always disappointed in us for something. Or perhaps we believe in the policeman God. You know, he's always tutting, he's always barking out orders, but does he actually help when it matters? And the real God says, no, actually relate to me as I truly am, on the basis of what I have revealed to you, not on the weird ideas that come into our head. He says to us, I am the God of Bethel. I am the down-to-earth God. I'm the God who comes to you in Jesus Christ, who speaks grace and love over you before you even started searching for me. And God says to us, I want you to relate to me as I actually am. So often we are slow to return to God after our sin because we think he's harsh and he's wagging his finger. And he says, put that out of your mind. I am this God. In whatever situation you're in, I am the God who comes to you in grace. We started with that question, what we're to do with this experience of heaven feeling closed to us. What about when faith feels like a subject we're not very good at school? What about when it feels like we've blown it with God? And we're just going to have to be God's little disappointment from now on. These were all Jacob's experience at the beginning of the passage. And I love this passage because it knocks all of those ideas out of the water. And it's the wonderful truth that in the midst of our mess and our sin, we have a God who comes to us in kindness. And of course, for us, we know this far more gloriously and beautifully than Jacob ever did, because we know that the Lord Jesus really did come from heaven to earth, and he permanently took flesh for us and died for us. And that means that we can actually give ourselves wholeheartedly to him. We can entrust ourselves to him. There is a chance for Q&A in a bit, but why don't we just come to God in the quiet and do business with God and say to him, just praise him for who he is. Maybe confess ways we have distorted images of him, and ask for his help to relate to him as he truly is, the God of Bethel. And then we'll have our prayers in a moment.